little bit this morning at the beginning about group relationships under communist idea of society, and it boils down to three groups. That's very difficult to resist the impulse to say it looks sort of like we're going to end up with classes all over again in this classless society, particularly the army. Because I suspect that wherever there is an army, there is always a military class, always has been, and there is in Russia today. In China, I think primarily by virtue of the fact that the men who successfully led the battle against Chiang Kai-shek and got communism in as the form of government, were all military men. They fought the war. Really, there doesn't tend to be too much difference between the party and the army in China. Now, as that older generation dies off, and they're all going to die rather rapidly because they're all in their high 70s and early 80s, and there aren't any young leaders. In China, who are coming along, but at any rate, those old military guys who are the party leaders, when they're gone, you know, don't know whether China will change into a military dictatorship that purports to be communist but really isn't, or whether we will have this tripartite group once again. One of the things that I find very fascinating about communism and whom it attracts is the fact that wherever you find a communist country, with the exception of Cuba, the top dogs are all old men. You know, even to be 60 is to be too young to lead, apparently. And yet there's a tremendous amount of attractiveness of communism to young people. And when you see it actually functioning, it tends to be quite elderly people who are running the government, not younger people at all. It doesn't seem to be the revolution of the young, except in countries that aren't communist. So I find that a little bit ironic. Well, at any rate, There are intended to be three groups, and it's very difficult to resist the impulse to say, all right, what you're going to have now then is, instead of a two-class society of fighting one another, you're going to have a three-class society instead of a classless society. And that is what is tended to happen. There are certain philosophically interesting counterparts to this tripartite thing. Plato's most famous dialogue is called The Republic, wherein he attempted to figure out what a perfect government would be like if perfect government were possible, and he didn't believe it was possible. But if it were possible, he thought it would be as he worked it out. And in that perfect society, there were three classes. The ruling class were called the guardians, and that's like the party here. Then there was a military class whose responsibility was to defend the society, and then everybody else was the third class. And it's sort of a counterpart like this, except the classes don't relate to one another as they do in Mao. But at any rate, we have three classes. And you know, as we were talking about yesterday and the day before, in a sense, the ideas are to be generated out of here. The party is to get the ideas from here and to function as the apparatus to work them into the society to achieve them. And the army, you know, enforces it and sees to it that what the party has decided is going to be the case is the case. In a sense, it's kind of a a strange sort of counterpart to our form of government, where you have the legislative, which here would be the people, the executive, which would be the party, and the judicial, which would be sort of like the army. If you attach the, you know, if you think of the police as judicial related rather than executive related. But it's kind of a strange counterpart of that sort of thing. But as you get more into the specifics of the situation, you begin to discover that there's another sort of entity which never really gets located anywhere, and so we'll just kind of free float it. And this is what he calls the intellectual. Now, I had ended yesterday by, or begun yesterday by talking about, in a sense, about the role of the intellectual in communist society. And in the classical Marxist, Leninist version, it was the intellectual who had to lead the communist revolution. It was the Fidel Castro, the lawyer with a doctor of jurisprudence degree, that had to lead the Cuban peasants in their revolution against the dictator Batista. And Che Guevara, his lieutenant, who was also university trained. The intellectuals who had to lead the dumb peasants, because the peasants don't have the education. So the intellectuals had to lead it. And Mao sort of sees the people as being the source of revolution and the ideas for revolution and so on. And yet all of a sudden, Mao starts talking about the intellectual. Who is the intellectual? The intellectual is the guy who has original ideas. And all of a sudden, our ideas aren't coming from the masses, they're coming from the intellectuals. And the intellectuals are supposed to have the ideas. Now, at the same time, he says, where does the intellectual get the ideas from? He gets the ideas from the people, and he tries them out on the people. And what this really boils down to is if you are a creative mind, you rub shoulders with the people, you work with the people, you interact with the people, and you get your ideas. But one of the masses doesn't come up to you and say, oh, you're a creative intellectual, here's a good idea for you. It doesn't work that way. They don't know when they are the source of an idea. And they really function as a kind of sounding board for ideas. You try them out on the people and see if they work, if they, you know, they generate enthusiasm, and then if it seems to turn them on, then the party's responsibility is to work these ideas into the structure of previously accepted ideas in the society. So all of a sudden we have a kind of an elite group emerging here, another class, the intellectual class. And, you know, all of a sudden you start, you know, if you have thought communism looked kind of good, all of a sudden you see, well, their class is starting to emerge here too. They're not economic classes, I suppose, and they don't count if they're not economic classes. But there are classes that are beginning to emerge here also, and as long as you have a classed society, according to the traditional theory, you aren't going to get into the communist society, and you will continue to have a kind of government to keep each class out of the other classes' hair, keep the intellectuals from trying to run the country, or the people from trying to institute a pure democracy and vote on what's going to happen and vote out the party. You know, or the party trying to take over and have the original ideas and so on, or the army trying to institute a military dictatorship. There's going to have to be some kind of balancing of powers to keep it from going one way or the other. Now, we happen to have a form of government where we built into this structure an awful lot of latitude, but at the same time, at least so far it's worked for almost 200 years, the impossibility of one branch of government getting so much power that it can do away with the other two. You don't have that built into the communist theory. And so it is very possible for the army to take over. It's very possible for the party to take over. And it's very possible for the people to throw the army and the party out. You know, the potentialities for anarchy or for complete dictatorship are wide open. Now, what happened in the Soviet Union after the death of Lenin very obviously was, you know, complete domination by the party, and the party completely dominated by one man, Stalin. And this is why Khrushchev, and then after him, Mao, made so much of the notion of the cult of the individual, because this is one of the weaknesses in the political fabric of the communist approach to government. It is possible for the party to dominate and for the party to be dominated by the individual. And if you get a man in who knows how to centralize authority and centralize power, a Stalin-type person, you are going to get a one-man dictatorship, regardless of what you call your government. And you can still have these branches there. But it's going to be one guy calling the shots. And that's the way it'll be. And there's no kind of structure built there where you can kick him out. You know, other than somebody assassinating him, and he can also take reasonable precautions against that also. It's interesting to see that Mao thought that Khrushchev was rather like Stalin. And this is quite evident in the little red book also, that two things he didn't like about Khrushchev. Khrushchev, in his talking about the cult of the individual, was very much an individual. And number two, second thing he didn't like about Khrushchev, and this may have been even more important to him than the other, Khrushchev was a clod. He was aesthetically ignorant. You remember the United Nations bit where Khrushchev took his shoe off and pounded it on his desk? You know, typical of Khrushchev. He was a peasant. He was an ignorant man. He was offensive to any well-brought-up Chinese man. And so I suspect that this is also what turned Mao off on the whole Russian variety of communism. It was so uncultured, so uncouth, so brutal and elemental and just lacking in good taste. Not a single guy in the Kremlin that can write a decent poem. Well, see, part and parcel of the ancient Chinese tradition all the way back to Confucius is you must be adept at poetry or you can't get into politics. Mm-hmm. Every politician is a good poet. Mao's a good poet. Zhou Enlai is, well, I suppose if he weren't number two man, you know, he could be a little more, show a little bit more his ability, but you know, those that know the two of them say that Cho probably is a better poet, but he doesn't dare show it because he's number two man. See, but you know, they're cultured men. They appreciate music. And in China, poetry is a multimedia art because your poem is either 9 or 13 characters. And the characters are calligraphy. See, they're symbols and images, and you draw them with a fine pen. And every man's symbol is different from every other man's symbol, you know. So the word as you draw it is an art form. In addition to this, you do it on silk, and you do a painting that expresses the thought of the poem. So you have the thought of the poem, you have the way the poem looks, you have the texture of the silk cloth, and you have the painting, and that's the whole business, is the poem. There are not copies of poems. Each poem is an original, and you can't make a copy of that original. It's like painting in our Western world. The artist doesn't sit down and paint 20 identical paintings or something like that, nor do we have any kind of reproductive process of reproducing a painting. A painting is a only one-time kind of thing. Well, in China, poetry is a only one of a kind sort of thing. And this is a prerequisite for being a bureaucrat. See, it's just a totally different way of living from the kind of way we have. You know, about the only politician I know that has any kind of abilities in this direction is Gene McCarthy. You know, and from a success standpoint, he was rather unsuccessful, you know, from a political success standpoint. But an excellent poet and great fun to have around. Can you imagine what it would have been like if he'd been president of the United States? You know, and he would cancel a press conference because he was busy finishing a poem. It might be just as well. Or if the White House correspondents all would have to be culturally sophisticated in order to keep up with Gene, wouldn't that be fun? We'd have a different kind of a ball game. We sort of started going in that direction with John Kennedy, didn't we? Largely due to his wife's influence. But we started going in that direction also, you know, with Jack Kennedy, with Bobby Kennedy. Teddy, you know, was the one that got the bad grades at college and, you know, got kicked out for cheating and other things like that, you know, so we aren't going to get poetry from Teddy. But a cultural sophistication and refinement, you know, so you run head on to those Russian boors, you know, and all that they know anything about is hogs. You know, well, there's something aesthetically satisfying about a pork chop, at least for me, because it's one of my favorite forms of eating. You know, and ham. Well, ham isn't, you know, you can see, you know, there's a lovely curve to that pork chop, you know. Ham, not so much, you know, but pig, that's not an aesthetic idea. And so Khrushchev, you know, talking about pigs and corn and so on, that's, you know, he just wasn't an aesthete. But Cho is. And in 1957, Cho Enlai made a speech which I think was probably the most influential speech that any communist ever made, and which probably changed the course of history. And it's kind of ironic that about 3-4 months later he acted in a way completely contradictory to what he said in the speech. But it's in the little red book, and it's not contradicted, even though it was historically contradicted. But he made a speech which since then has become known as the Little Flowers speech, not having anything to do with St. Francis of Assisi. Sometimes it's called the Butterfly speech, and let me see if I can find it here, because I hadn't planned to mention it at this point, but it sort of worked out that way. Jerry, got your book today?
All right.
Okay, bottom of 302. Let 100 flowers blossom and 100 schools of thought content is the policy for promoting the progress of the arts and the sciences and a flourishing socialist culture in our land. Different forms and styles in art should develop freely. Different schools in science should contend freely. We think it is harmful to the growth of art and science if administrative measures are used to impose one particular style of art or school of thought and to ban another. Questions of right and wrong in the arts and sciences should be settled through free discussion in artistic and scientific circles and through practical work in these fields. They should not be settled in summary fashion. Put your finger in 301, Jerry. We'll get to that shortly. All right, how does that sound? Larry, you and I are academicians. How would you like that for a statement of academic freedom at your university?
That would be great.
That sound terrific? Cho En Lai said that in 1957, and wow, you know, university people around the world said, terrific, hey, let's take another look at this communism business. We always thought this was monolithic ideology, party line, you know, you paint the way the party says, you do science the way the party says, everybody's got to be, who is the psychologist, Lamarckian. Everybody's got to be a Lamarckian, take a Lamarckian approach to psychology. No other approach possible. You know, everything prescribed, preset, the role of the university is to indoctrinate, not free and free and so on. Here Cho En Lai comes along and says, you know, let 100 flowers blossom. And all of a sudden, communism was off in a new direction. And in China, everybody was having a great time arguing, including arguing for alternative forms of government other than communism. You know, because that's what you're telling the political scientists to do, right? You treat communism as one of a variety of kinds of ways of organizing people. And they were having one great time. And scholars all around the world were saying, hey, look what's going on in China. The great cultural leap forward, the whole business, see? And about 3 months later, all of a sudden, all of the guys that were saying, hey, there may be better forms of government than communism, found themselves in jail. And all of a sudden, we went monolithic, see? Just as much as the Russians had. But the statement's in the book, see? And this is changed the whole ball game, even though Mao clamped down. And then there's another statement, and I'll work that one and take that one on bottom of 301, Jerry, and top of 302.
In literary and art criticism, there are two criteria, the political and the artistic.
I see two.
There's a political criterion and there's the artistic criterion. What is the relationship between the two? Politics cannot be equated with art, nor can a general world outlook be equated with a method of artistic creation and criticism. We deny not only that there is an abstract, an absolutely unchangeable political criterion, but also that there is an abstract and absolutely unchangeable artistic criterion. Each class in every society has its own political and artistic criteria. But all classes and all class societies invariably put the political criterion first and the artistic criterion second. What we demand is the unity of politics and art, the unity of content and form, the unity of revolutionary political content, and the highest possible perfection of artistic form. Works of art which lack artistic quality have no force, however progressive they are politically. Therefore, we oppose both works of art with a wrong political viewpoint and a tendency towards the poster and slogan style which is correct in political viewpoint, but lacking in artistic power. On questions of literature and art, we must carry on a struggle on two fronts.
All right, now, that poster art, see, that's Russian stuff.
But that was a 42 publication. Yeah, that was a 42 statement.
1942 statement, yeah. And still observed in China. The Russian attitude toward the arts reduces the arts to political propaganda for the party. You know, and so you generate one movie after another where you have this fantastic love affair between the young communist youth and his tractor. You know, and at the end of the movie, you know, you have boy meets tractor, boy falls in love with tractor, boy drives tractor breaks down, boy can't figure out what is wrong with tractor, boy gets help from friend, tractor works, boy and tractor are reunited, and boy drives tractor off into the sunset, you know. Another great Russian epic. See, that sort of thing. Or you get it in painting, too, see. A bunch of 19th century social realistic garbage. In the art field, in the literature field, in the movie field, the whole business. In music field, you submit your ideas to the central party, and the central party okays them or doesn't okay them, and if they okay them, then you work them out. See? And then you submit your finished work to the party for criticism. And what's important is it party line-ish or isn't it? Is it fostering the love for Russian communism or isn't it? See? And these are your criteria. And, you know, one of the surprising things about this sort of thing is more often than not, this is the sort of thing that happens in the church. In the church's attitude toward art. Write me a play that my young people can put on so that more people go to communion. Right? See, that was a terrible movie. There were two curse words in it. See, now we sometimes tend to take that kind of approach to the arts also, which makes the artists, you know, they really cringe and get frustrated. Well, this is Russian art. You can imagine what the writers and the painters and the musicians thought when they hear this from Cho Enlai, who said, there are two standards that must be satisfied, one of which is objective artistic aesthetic standards. And you can produce something that is party line-ish all the way up and down the line, and if it's aesthetically lousy, it's no good. And we aren't going to reproduce it. It takes more than simply being compatible with communist ideology for something to get bought in China. You may be able to sell it in the Soviet Union, but you sure aren't going to sell it in China. Well, anybody that has looked at some Chinese art, you know that it's one thing to say something, it's another thing to achieve it, and I suspect that that business about being politically satisfactory is rather frustrating to Chinese artists, and may well be that Chinese mentality, being the way that it is, that concern about being ideologically pure is going to gradually sort of fade into the background. Although, to a great extent, in Chinese poetry particularly, Chinese poetry tends to be almost exclusively lyric poetry. Well, when you've got only so many characters to constitute a poem, you certainly can't write an epic, can you? But it is lyric poetry, once again, largely of two kinds. One, landscape poetry, you know, where you simply comment on a scene, or subjective poetry where you express your feelings about something or other. Then you can probably do a rather good poem about how you felt when the parade came by your apartment and the great portrait of Comrade Mao was swaying from a banner. And, you know, you could write a rather good poem about the kind of feelings you had about that, see? So you don't feel really that hamstrung in the area of poetry. In the area of drama, though, you do run into problems. Because quite obviously, the natural impulse is going to be like the impulse that dramatists are feeling in the United States right now as we're in the bicentennial business.
Write us a good patriotic play. Write us a good musical that is on American Revolution themes, you know, and that will be better than 1776.
You know, and it's one thing, you know, or
write me an opera.
Got a big kick in Chicago. A Lyric Opera Company is probably, right now, is probably the best opera company in the country. But it doesn't happen to be a resident opera company like the Metropolitan, San Francisco, and several other ones. But the Lyric Opera decided to commission an opera for the bicentennial. It'll be done next fall. Who did they commission to write it? Penderecki, the Polish composer. He's a good composer, but he's writing the Lyrics Opera too. And I don't think it's going to have anything to do with the United States at all. Yeah, I did hear somewhere along the line what it's going to be. I don't think it would have anything to do with the United States. So it would just simply a concurrent composition. But at any rate, you know, there's that urge. And so what has come out of China in the area of drama and light opera, you know, has been rather bad. The most famous musical that has been done in communist China is called The Red Star. And it's more ballet than it's drama. Heroine is a young communist maiden who is captured by bandits, you know, and things look hopeless for her, and she believes firmly in the Red Star of communism, and the communist young troops come and gather, and they free her, and they dance wildly about the stage at the end, you know, praising the glories of communism for having brought people together. Yeah, that sort of thing. It's just a real ideological binge.
Mm-hmm. Bill, culturally, though, the Chinese have a history of dramatic...
No.
I mean, what wasn't one of the...
It's strongly stylized.
The calligraphy, and the calligraphy itself became the art form, and it would take a person maybe 10 to 15 years to become an adequate calligrapher. Therefore... all the emphasis was on the style, and there was never a form to put people into conflict, as in the Western culture.
Yeah. Now they have, and they have a cultural shock problem also, because their dominant art form has always been poetry. Now that music has been there. Music has been there in its current form much longer than Western music has been around. Western music, as we know it, is about a Renaissance development. And it's right about the time of the Renaissance that modern notation is developed. The Chinese, with traditional Chinese music, they have no system of notation. You know, so it's taught from father to son, and which means that you don't get much development. They work with a five-tone scale, and this is limiting. And they operate with what you could call instrumental disorientation. In other words, you have certain instruments in the orchestra
who play according to a time system. So every 6 seconds, this one instrument that has one string on it goes bong, bong, and it just every 6 seconds goes bong. Now, regardless of what the other ones are doing, it just does that. And maybe a guy is playing a gong, and every 14 seconds he hits the gong. But it's got nothing to do with that bang. And then you've got somebody else who is playing a multi-string instrument, and he is playing the same seven notes over and over again, but each time subtly different. And this number is 11 minutes long to the second. And there's a great deal of intellectualizing about it, but it's intellectualized in a quite different way than Bach's music is intellectualized, because Bach's music is almost like worked out by mathematical formula, and everything, every part fits every other part. You know, it's a magnificent architectonic structure. Well, in the Chinese, the old Chinese music, you have, it is simply kind of conventions. This instrument conventionally plays every 7 seconds and goes bong. You know, and that's the way that instrument is played. It's every 7 second instrument. And, you know, this is a 14 second gong, and here's a 20 second gong, and so on, you know. And so these things, these are conventions. And so the conventions are just set next to one another. And what they tend to do is analytic music. In other words, they explore a small number of sounds. Just, I don't know whether any of you are familiar with analytic philosophy, which is one of the 20th century forms of philosophy, where you don't work out a big worldview and explain all of reality, you know, which was the old traditional approach to philosophy, but you take something like a sentence, this dog is a mongrel, and you analyze what is the full meaning of that sentence. See, and you know, you just work that thing, every little shred, and take it apart. And it's horribly tedious reading. Now, you may suspect I'm not an analytic philosopher, but you know, it goes into very fine detail. Well, traditional Chinese music is analytical. And so you sit there, you know, and you savor every subtle little nuance of sound. With a very small, you get a very small stimulus from the orchestra. And you just savor every subtle little nuance of sound. What's the Western tradition? You get inundated with sounds, don't you? Boom, it just comes pouring out. I was thinking of Claire playing the Bach the other night, you know. And you get a couple thousand sounds thrown at you in 4 minutes. See? We do extensive music, and we do big structured music. You know, you have a chord a half mile high with a big orchestra. See, we have just a totally different approach to music from the classical Chinese approach. So it takes a different kind of mentality. Well, what have the Chinese communists been doing? Western music. They're trying to do it. And so they're going through a period of trying to understand what Western music's all about. Because, you know, communism is, for them, is Tchaikovsky and Mussorgsky and all the other Russians. See, because the communism came down from Russia, and if the Russians can do Swan Lake Ballet, dancing must be good for communists. And Western music and so on. So they're busy becoming westernized and don't know it. Mm-hmm. And so they're trying to do Western music, and they're doing it very well.
Is there an envy factor of China over Russia because Russia got there first?
No. Because
The Chinese are incapable of envying anybody because they know they're better than everybody.
And why are they?
They have been around longer than anybody else has. I think they probably see it ideologically rather than culturally. And so, you see, all the models of communist art they've got from Russia. And it's the only thing they've got to work with. Now, they see traditional Chinese art as Confucian-related, which is decadent. And so they are struggling very hard in the world of art to come up with something that's going to be authentic. But they're working off of Russian models, and the Russian models, of course, are 19th century romantic, early 20th century social realistic, you know, and having a common characteristic of sentimentality.
My one daughter saw the art recent to Communist China art exhibit in Kansas City.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they had all these artifacts.
Yes.
China, but she said it was real strange. It was, they're kind of limited. You just see what they want you to see.
Right. Yeah. Also, and I'm glad you mentioned that, you know, because they're very frustrated because it's not coming to Chicago.
Yeah.
But it is also the best collection of Chinese art that has ever been in the country. Now, we know they got better than what they sent here. And a lot of it is old Chinese art. But they have a long history, you know, in enamels, ceramics, mosaics. You know, they're the best enamel people in the world. And the Ming vases and, you know, all this sort of thing. And Chinese, well, you know, we say China. Why do we call our dishware China? Because China was the paradigm country for that. You see, they have a long history of that. They have a long history of screens, you know, with paintings on screens and a certain delicacy. And a certain economy of design and economy of line that we've tried desperately to copy in the 20th century. Well, they've got all that in their heritage that they can work with. So, in that area, in architecture, in poetry, they have very little trouble. But they're having problems with music, and they're having problems with drama. Their dancing is so traditional and Confucian and court related that, you know, they're having problems with that. I suppose it would be kind of like a counterpart if right now we changed our form of government, we introduced a form of government that believed that the arts had to copy, state, reinforce the ideology of the government. And the drama which we did today was drama like Molière and Racine, where all of our females had big hoop skirts and white wigs, and, you know, the guys were all like that. It was all formal, and the only music we had was minuets. Can you imagine what it would be like if the only music, the only dance form we had was minuet? And right now we were trying to express communist ideology in minuet form. See, you're just kind of trapped. But it's interesting to see that in spite of those kinds of problems, Mao said it's got to be aesthetically satisfactory. It can't just be good party line. Well, this is another thing that has made communism attractive, where in the Russian variety it wasn't. Because you had, without exception, you had artists turned off by Russian communism, thinkers turned off by Russian communism, scholars turned off by Russian communism. You know, it was ignorant, boorish crap. And it got nowhere in the universities. you know, a little spate about 35, and we were in the depths of depression, and some of the social scientists thought maybe that kind of direction would get us out of the trough. But, you know, that lasted about a year or so, that the intellectuals didn't go for it. So all of a sudden, you got a guy who comes along and he's saying things that appeal to university profs, that appeal to artists, that appeal to writers. See, all of a sudden you got a whole different ball game. And, you know, it sounds so good you're willing to overlook a few things. You know, like behavior. So anyway, this is one way in which it's worked. So I got time for nothing. And the bell is late. Maybe the bell is waterlogged. Well, at any rate, this is fun and frustrating. We talked about some good things today, even though it wasn't what I planned to talk about, right?
Yeah. Here's Mr. Krishna. He's a new thing.
Well, that's Russian. Mr. Brezhnev is a bit more cultured than Mr. Khrushchev was.
Yes.
And he also seems to be a rather decent person. As far as we've been able to tell, he is anti-military in the Soviet Union, and he has been successful in keeping down two groups. One is the military, who want to go out there and, you know, pitch their missiles against our missiles and see who can win. So he's been able to keep the military under control in the Soviet Union, and he's also been able to keep under control the old hardline Stalinists. Now, you recall, you know, about 3 months ago, Alexander Shalapin retired. See, retired, that's another word for lost power. Well, Shalapin was the last of the powerful Stalinists. And so we got a new breed of people. Now, Brezhnev has not been in the best of health. And he periodically kind of disappeared from sight. And we don't really know what's wrong with him. But then he pops up again. But he seems to be a, you know, fairly reasonable guy to deal with and to negotiate with. Apparently both Mr. Nixon and Mr. Ford were personally and politically impressed by him.
Do you think Mao ever did take that swim?
Oh, I think so. He was very vigorous. You mean in the was the Yellow River?
Yeah.
I think so, yeah. He hasn't since. I would. That's a pretty polluted stream. But I guess he felt he had to, well, I guess even when you are a great symbol, every once in a while you got to prove your manhood. And that was why he did, you know.
Yeah.
They were saying he was over the hill and he had to go out and prove that he had still had vigor. Well, it's been frustrating and fun this week, and I hope it's been worth your while to be with me.
Oh, yes.
I'd say from a positive standpoint, you have left me with probably another week's worth of topics that we can talk about. I don't know what's going to happen next week, but I may do a few more things next week. Thank you all.